You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. A spyware version of Mirai has been detected in the wild. The People's Liberation Army is told by its government to lighten up on U.S. election stories. Centripetal wins a major patent lawsuit. Excel is not a big data tool. John McAfee is arrested on U.S. tax charges. Our guest is Roger Baranko from Akamai on tracking increased DDoS attacks. Ben Yellen on a case involving warrants for Wi-Fi location data. And an aid to chastity is found to be hackable. From the CyberWire studios at Datatribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Tuesday, October 6, 2020. ThreatPost reports that 360 NetLab researchers have found a version of Mirai botnet malware, T-Tint, in the wild, operating against Tendra routers. T-Tint has both remote access Trojan and spyware functionality. Information operators in China's People's Liberation Army have been told to go easy on stories about the U.S. election, the South China Morning Post reports. This seems less an ironic gesture than it does a ratcheting up of central control over a campaign that could run in directions not necessarily to the Chinese Communist Party's advantage. Centripetal Networks has won a large judgment in its patent infringement case against Cisco. The United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia found in favor of Centripetal and ordered the defendant to pay, according to Bloomberg, $1.9 billion to the security firm. A press release from Herndon, Virginia-based Centripetal calls the award the largest of its kind issued by a U.S. court. Have you noticed a big surge in the number of COVID-19 cases reported over across the pond in the mother country? So have a lot of people in England. But that's actually an IT issue as opposed to a clinical one. A spike in English COVID-19 cases may be due not to infection, but to bureaucratic misunderstanding of Office 365. Public Health England said it had corrected a technical issue in the data load process
by which officials shared positive test results. Public Health England isn't saying much more, but according to The Independent, Prime Minister Johnson has been forthcoming in ascribing the glitch to a failure to appreciate that Microsoft Excel spreadsheets have limits in the number of rows and columns they can handle, so the data was truncated. Excel is a useful product, but it's not intended to be a big data tool. The U.S. Justice Department has indicted security pioneer and inveterate bad boy John McAfee on 10 counts related to income tax evasion. CoinDesk reports that Spanish police have arrested him pursuant to a U.S. request and that he presumably faces extradition proceedings. Unpleasant as this all is, it's not the end of his legal problems, unfortunately. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has also filed a civil complaint against Mr. McAfee in connection with his involvement in pumping altcoin offerings. The commission alleges that he, as the SEC puts it, leveraged his fame to make more than $23.1 million U.S. dollars in undisclosed compensation by recommending at least 7 initial coin offerings, or ICOs, to his Twitter followers. The ICOs at issue involve the offer and sale of digital asset securities, and McAfee's recommendations were materially false and misleading for several reasons. The specific improprieties the SEC alleges are interesting. First, he didn't disclose that his promotion of the ICOs was compensated by the companies issuing the securities. The SEC calls this unlawful touting, for which he made around $23.2 million. Which he is said to have kept quiet about not only to prospective investors, but to the Internal Revenue Service as well. The SEC also says he lied to investors when they directly asked him if he were being compensated for his endorsement. Second, Mr. McAfee is said to have falsely claimed to be either an investor or a technical advisor to the issuers, which suggested to prospective investors that he'd checked the issuing companies out, and that his recommendation was well-informed, impartial investment advice. Third, after a blogger exposed what was going on, Mr. McAfee sought to cash out a large number of virtually worthless securities from the ICOs he had previously touted. He allegedly did so by encouraging investors to buy while he himself was trying to dump his holdings. Finally, he's said to have engaged in what the SEC calls scalping, which involves accumulating large amounts of the digital asset security and touting it on Twitter without disclosing his intent to sell it. The SEC wants to disgorge, as they put it, the millions he made, and to enjoin Mr. McAfee from doing the same in the future. So, don't do likewise. We should also note that while Mr. McAfee founded the company that still bears his name, he's had no connection with it for a couple of decades. Finally, have you considered a network-connected marital aid? Of course not. Neither have we. But someone apparently has. TechCrunch reports that a digital smart male chastity appliance, and we hesitate here because it's not entirely clear whether this would be a chastity enforcer or a device that promises some form of gratification, and we confess we're generally unfamiliar with the sector as a whole. A smart male chastity appliance is apparently hackable. Pentest Partners said the device in question, the Qui Cellmate Internet-Connected Chastity Lock, which the manufacturer says is the world's first app-controlled chastity device, could have allowed anyone to remotely and permanently lock in the user's membrum virile. The ominously named Cellmate is lockable and unlockable via an app, because of course it is. And unfortunately, said app was at one point unprotected by a password, so any interested party wouldn't need so much as an open sesame to take charge. Anywho, Pentest Partners contacted the manufacturer, who said they'd installed some password functionality, but alas, they also left the original unprotected access open. We'll spare you the jolly back and forth that has surrounded the discovery of this particular vulnerability, but suffice it to say that not only is the app in question easily accessed, but there's no override either. The manufacturer told TechCrunch they were working on a fix, but 4 deadlines have come and gone, and No fix is in. They're a small shop, the manufacturer pleaded in its defense, saying that every time they fixed something, they broke something else. People familiar with the technology, and again, we're not, say that absent an override, it appears that only the careful, and we stress careful, use of bolt cutters or a lateral grinder will free a trapped user. It seems to us that all the reporting has buried the lead. The cellmate has actual users. Yikes. Who knew? But there you go. In case you're asking for a friend, bring your bolt cutters. A wire-cutting plier won't cut it. Or so we've been told.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Researchers at Akamai have been tracking how DDoS attacks continue to get bigger and in some cases more sophisticated, showing that they are still a weapon of choice for threat actors. Roger Barranco is Vice President of Global Security Operations at Akamai.
If it was maybe this time last year, I would have reported that things are, always increasing, but nothing really exciting going on. And then towards the beginning of this year, I expected to see a big spike because of all the COVID-related items. And we really didn't see anything directly tied to COVID. But oh my goodness, the last, I'd say 4 months, the activity has been huge. So two attacks were certainly in the record-breaking range, one being 1.44 terabits in size. The other, which is truly a record that I'm aware of, it was 809 million packets per second. From that day, there's been quite a bit of activity. We've seen a big spike in attacks over 100 gig in size. And the number of attacks is really spiking up also. And there seems to be a newfound interest with DDoS because quite a bit of extortion-related activity going on also.
Can you dig into that a little bit? I mean, what sort of things are you tracking in terms of what's behind these attacks?
Yeah, so, typically we haven't been able to tie it back to a specific threat actor. It seems like a lot of different actors out there. And what's happening is these extortion-type letters are going out to different verticals, and they're asking, no surprise for Bitcoin. To be paid out. I think the thing that is interesting is that they seem to be going vertical by vertical. So they would go, first to, no surprise, banking. After that, the, airlines, then hoteling industries. And they're just going vertical by vertical, rolling these threats out, which does indicate, a fair amount of coordination.
And where do we stand in terms of the botnets themselves? I mean, do they just continue to grow in size and capability?
So that's a really good question. So we haven't seen anything radically new from a vector perspective. So we've seen some newer vectors, but nothing radically new. So the world's largest DDoS that I'm aware of was actually a reflection, CLDAP reflection attack, handled by AWS. That was 2.3 terabits in size and from a bit per second. The 1.44 terabit attack that was handled by Akamai had 9 different vectors in there. So they're mixing it up where the Akamai one with 9 vectors, the AWS one huge with 1 vector, right? 1 massive punch with that. Now, interestingly enough, the Akamai one actually had a higher packet rate than the AWS one. So they're nuanced. And then clearly the largest from a packet per second, that was definitely, like you said before, bot related. And the 809 million packet per second one. And that clearly shows that because there's so much IoT out there available, that these tools have greater access to more devices to launch attacks than they've ever had in the past. Hence, it's easier to launch a very large attack.
That's Roger Barranco from Akamai.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And joining me once again is Ben Yellen. He is from the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security, also my co-host over on the Caveat podcast, which if you have not yet checked out, what are you waiting for? Check
Seriously,
it out, right,
people.
Ben? it's a good show.
Subscribe to this awesome podcast.
There you go. So, Ben, we've got an interesting story this week. This is from NBC News. It's from John Shoup and Cyrus Farivar, who I've spoken to on the CyberWire before. It's titled, Police Need Warrant to Obtain Wi-Fi Location Data, Privacy Activists Argue. Give us the background here. What's going on?
So it's a fascinating case. It emanates from an incident that took place in 2017 where a member of this college's football team, and it's Moravia College in Pennsylvania, held up somebody in a dorm room at gunpoint to extract money and a jar of marijuana. And part of the evidence used to obtain a conviction of this individual was that he was logged on to the campus Wi-Fi system. Now, there was no authorization for law enforcement from a judge. There was no warrant issued here to obtain that identifying information to confirm that he was part of that he was logged onto campus Wi-Fi. That was all obtained using an administrative subpoena. So this defendant, a guy by the name of Duncans, is appealing his conviction that this is a violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. And he's being joined by some of the major groups out there who advocate for digital privacy, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the American Civil Liberties Union. What this defendant is saying is that this search violates his right to privacy. It is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. His attorneys and some of these outside groups are analogizing this case to Carpenter v. United States, which I know we've talked about on this podcast and on our own podcast, where the Supreme Court held that a warrant is required for cell site location information that tracks a person's movement over time. What the prosecutors are saying is that this is not analogous to Carpenter. This is not a case where they're tracking one individual's movements in multiple locations. through an extended time period, but rather they were seeing which individuals were at a given location at a particular time. Mm-hmm. And they're also claiming that Mr. Duncan's did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy when he connected to that Wi-Fi network. And one of the reasons they say that is in order to get campus Wi-Fi, you have to sign those terms of service. Which says that you don't have
busted by a EULA.
You're always going to get busted by those EULAs. And that explicitly says, you know, in so many words, be cautious, my friends. By logging onto this Wi-Fi, nothing you do here is private. We can see exactly what you're doing. You've relinquished your expectation of privacy. And if we happen to turn that over to the police, that's your problem. I happen to think in this case that the prosecutors have a stronger argument in terms of where case law has been on the Fourth Amendment. The reason I think that this is different from Carpenter is, you know, as the prosecutors are saying here, we're not talking about the type of pervasive, ongoing, involuntary surveillance that we saw when we're talking about cell site location information. You know, a person really doesn't have a choice as to whether to use a cell phone. And because cell phones are constantly pinging towers to make sure that they're getting service, this process sort of happens involuntarily. You know, nobody presses a button where they say, I agree to share my location at every single second that they're carrying around their cell phone. Right. Here, this individual pretty clearly, in my view, relinquished their reasonable expectation of privacy when they signed that EULA. Despite
a EULA that he most assuredly did not read.
Oh, of course he didn't read it. But it's largely still enforceable. I just don't think that is the same type of broad, deep, and pervasive surveillance that the court feared in coming up with the Carpenter decision. So that's my perspective. It's a fascinating case. And I suspect, this is the type of case that potentially could inch its way up our court system and perhaps merit Supreme Court consideration, if it's something where we see a split among judicial circuits.
All right. Well, it's an interesting one for sure. Ben Yellen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. The CyberWire, it's what's for dinner. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.